This is the story of the one. As a custodial supervisor at a high school, he knows that during cold and flu season, germs spread fast. It's why he partners with Grainger to stay fully stocked on the products and supplies he needs, from tissues to disinfectants to floor scrubbers. Also that he can help students, staff, and teachers stay healthy and focused. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to Scoop, where you get the scoop on this week's news. My name is Jenna, and this is Smarter News. Well, hello, everyone, from a chilly and cool Central Texas day. It's just about 70 degrees, and suddenly it feels like fall. It is something that we anticipate here in Texas because it's just so dang hot all the time. And I was sharing with some of our Scoop insiders today that my children all were looking for sweatshirts this morning because it was about 60 degrees. But that's just because we're not acclimated yet. We're not sure what to do, what it's kind of borderline. We're not completely sure in Texas. Is it here to stay? I just got a great request on our live feed from Candace, who's my neighbor here. I don't know her personally, but Candace, we're neighbors apparently because we live very close to each other. If I could request from the weather people in Texas to keep the weather this way, that would be great. Unfortunately, we know it's going to be back at 100 degrees at some point because that's just the way that Texas likes to just kind of turn up the dial on people. And we can't take that this week, you guys. We can't. We just can't because it's such an interesting week in news. We're going to need that crisp, calm, cool weather so we can extend it to our own posture throughout this week because we've got a lot of politics this week. We also have a lot of emotional news. And I always want to leave some room for that because when we mark a date like September 11th, there's an emotional toll and reaction to that, as there should be, because it's one of the most significant events in American history. And so we got to leave some space for that. And as we've talked about over the last couple of weeks, I think it's important to remind ourselves is during this period of time, there's that thin sort of veil of like political stress. Even if you don't find yourself that political or that connected, it's just this, all the talk about politics in the election just adds that little something, that little layer on top, which can cause a little extra stress and anxiety in our lives. And I think if we're just aware of that, it's helpful. At least it's helpful to me. And I love being able to share some of this with you. What's interesting about this week, which we know is historic again because of marking September 11th, and we also know we have a political debate that's taking place tomorrow on Tuesday that will undoubtedly impact the election of 2024. In some capacity, we don't know in what capacity, but it will. The context for this week, the historic nature of this week, it's very remarkable. So think about this. We're starting this week on Monday. This Monday marks a interesting moment in the Continental Congress going back to 1776. It was the time where the Continental Congress decided, even though we had declared our independence and we said, listen, we're going to be the United States, we're going to be independent of the British reach, we officially named ourselves on this day in history, the United States of America. And it's still a mystery as to how that actually took place. We know that the United States of America was written in the Declaration of Independence, but when you look at the writing, in the early writing, the United States isn't capitalized. So it's United States lowercase of America. You know, and let me just go back because I want to double check this. This was the moment where suddenly we became the title in which we are today, but we don't know exactly who did it. We know Thomas Jefferson was writing the Declaration of Independence. But whether this was just like a mistake or this was a term that was being used actively, it's sort of still a mystery. And so on this day in history, we got our name, like officially. And here we are so many years later. If we look at the end of the week, we're going to mark the Star-Spangled Banner, which we also know is celebrating an important victory in American history. And that song over the years has brought up a lot of obviously different feelings. There even was a rejection of the song early on, not because of any of the content particularly because of the lyrics, although we've definitely seen that debate recently in recent times. It was because the song is difficult to sing. And there was a concern about whether or not the American population would be able to sing it. It wouldn't be easy enough for us to do. So this has been a week that historically gives us something to think about when it comes to the American identity. You know, what if we had a different name? You know, what if we'd had a different song? How would that change just how we feel about the country overall? And it's just sort of ironic that it's all happening on the same week. If we look back on July 4th, like the holidays or the dates around July 4th, July 2nd, 3rd, 4th, we also see a lot of really momentous periods or moments in American history throughout the years around those dates. And there's no rhyme or reason to that. You know, it's not like anyone could be like, you know what, we're going to have the Battle of Gettysburg right on around the date of American independence, because that's going to be very lyrical for American history. Like, no one can plan that. These sort of things just sort of happen. And these are the moments in journalism and in our stories where it's almost unexplainable. So we have this other moment coming into this week where we have an important anniversary. You have to be careful with that word, because anniversary sounds like a celebration of September 11th, and that's not what I'm insinuating, but it's a moment that we're marking, an annual moment that we're marking. And we also are getting closer into the election day of 2024, which is historic because we've only had, you know, several dozen presidential elections in American history when you really think about it. You know, it's not like we've had hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. No, we haven't. So I think understanding that context for this week of news is important. And as we're getting into this, I wanted to share a fascinating article with you that I saw just going into the weekend. And this is just a reminder that history continues to be discovered in amazing ways. So the title of this article is "A Rare Copy of the U.S. Constitution Went Missing for Centuries. Now it's being auctioned for millions." And this is what the Associated Press writes. Historical document appraiser and collector Seth Keller spreads a broad sheet of paper across a desk. It's in good enough condition that he can handle it carefully with clean, bare hands. There are just a few creases and tiny discolorations, even though it's just a few weeks shy of 237 years old and has spent who knows how long inside a filing cabinet in North Carolina. At the top of the first page are familiar words, but in regular type, instead of the sweeping Gothic script we're used to seeing, "We the People." And the people will get a chance to bid for this copy of the U.S. Constitution, the only of its type thought to be in private hands, at a sale by Brunk Auctions on September 28th in Asheville, North Carolina. The minimum bid for the auction of $1 million has already been made. There is no minimum price that must be reached. And it goes on to say, so it looks like there was about 100 copies printed by the secretary of that Congress, Charles Thompson. Just 8 are known to still be in existence. And the 7 others are publicly owned. So this is very rare. Where was this? Okay. So let me read you a little bit about how they found this in some filing cabinet. 2 years ago, a property was being cleared out in Eddington in eastern North Carolina that was once owned by Samuel Johnson. He was the governor of North Carolina from 1787 to 1789, and he oversaw the state convention during his last year in office that ratified the Constitution. The copy was found inside a squat 2-drawer metal filing cabinet with a can of stain on top, in a long neglected room piled high with old chairs and dusty bookcase before the old Johnston house was preserved. The document was a broadsheet that could be folded one time like a book. Now, we do spring cleaning. Maybe this is a reminder we should do some fall cleaning, because you never know what you might find in the attic of your home. We don't know. Okay. So this is going back to the person that appraises and sells historic documents. He says this. He says, "I get calls every week from people who think they have a Declaration of Independence or a Gettysburg Address. Most of the time it's just a replica, but every so often something important gets found." And that certainly was it. So how much do you think this could be auctioned for? You know, what do you think could be the range? So we know 1 million just to start it. Here's a little context. In 2021, Sotheby's of New York sold one of only 14 remaining copies of the Constitution printed for the Continental Congress and delegates to the Constitutional Convention for $43.2 million. I sent this to my husband and he was like, "You want to bid on it?" I was like, "You got $40 million that we could just to throw around?" I had no idea it could be that, I mean, it could be that high. So, but what a remarkable find, just in a filing cabinet, in a room just piled with old junk. And there it was. So there are always things to discover, and it's a reminder when we feel like there's an overexposure or too much information. There's always a mystery out there and maybe something that we can find. So let's talk a little bit about politics. And as we have the setting and thinking back to those times when our nation was so young and we were thinking about not only, you know, how elections were going to be run, but how was the government going to be structured? Now look at us, more than 200 years later, and we're into these televised presidential debates and a battle of social media accounts and working towards yet another presidential election with some uncertainty. Let me just say this. I heard this morning. I'm sure you all have heard a little lot when people say this is the most important election of our lifetime. Have you heard that? This is the most important election of our lifetime. And I thought this morning, that's something, number one, I would never say in Smarter News, because I don't know what could be the most important election in your lifetime. But also, I hope to have a few more years, you know? Like, let's be cool, all right? We might have some really important elections coming up. This could be the most important in our lifetime. But I wonder if most people felt that way. You know, at different crossroads in American history, this is going to be the most pivotal election, whether it was, you know, the ones following the American Revolution, or even really the forgotten war of 1812, where we really could have lost everything again coming out of that. What about after the Civil War? I mean, there's a lot of important moments in American history. And that's been sort of our story of tension and fighting and sometimes chaos, and then emerging on the other side of it. That pattern has repeated itself. And so I'm not going to use that disclaimer, although I'm curious if you think it's the most important and the reasons why. It's not that I would argue with you if you felt that way. I just feel that the news doesn't have any business stating that when we have no way of telling the future. So this is an important election, just like all elections are critical. And as we're looking towards what's the next couple of weeks looks like, we're going to be really looking at this presidential debate because it's going to set a tone. This is the first time that we're seeing Vice President Harris and former President Trump face off. And it might actually be the only time. We know that there was a series of debates that were agreed upon when President Biden was still in the race. But we actually don't know if this is just the one and only. So this might be a one and done. And if that's the case, the stakes of this presidential debate are perhaps even higher, because this is the time that we're going to be able to see the two candidates on stage. And what makes debates really important is in this time when there's a lot of manufactured content, these are the live broadcasts that can actually produce authentic moments where reactions happen and words are used. There's an expression on someone's face. There's a way someone is standing. And that's what we connect to as humans, is not just all these slogans. It's actually seeing someone in for a moment, perhaps seeing them authentically. Sure, there's going to be a lot of thinking about the right positioning for these candidates ahead of time. But we know that once that live broadcast starts for 90 minutes, we have no idea what's going to happen. And we certainly had an example of that in late June, which forever changed the course of this election. So just so you have an idea of what this debate's going to look like, it's going to be 90 minutes. There's going to be two commercial breaks. ABC is going to be hosting it. David Muir, who is the evening news anchor for ABC, is going to be part of it, as well as Lindsay Davis, who's also a very prominent journalist on the ABC network. There's not going to be a live audience. So there's going to be no live audience reaction. And for now, our understanding is that ABC is going to keep someone muted if they're not answering a question. And they're going to get plenty of time to answer a question. It's going to be about 2 minutes. They're going to get a 2-minute rebuttal. There's going to be time for them to do it. There was a question by the Biden campaign going back to that first debate about muting or not muting the microphone, because former President Trump, I don't think this is stating the obvious, has a tendency to talk when other people are talking. And so there was thinking strategically of, well, if everyone's mic is muted, then everyone can hear the person talking that's supposed to be talking. But there's a question about whether or not that also impacted the debate unfairly in some ways, because, for example, you could see President Biden speaking, but maybe you didn't see that he could hear former President Trump talking at the same time, and vice versa. And so it's an interesting editorial question for networks about whether or not to do this and how to do it. So we'll see how this actually plays out. It's in Philadelphia, again, ironically, just thinking about the history, the home of the Constitutional Convention, right? And the Declaration of Independence and the signing of the Constitution. And it's just the night before September 11th. So I'm curious about how they position this debate editorially. There's a lot of news when it comes to foreign affairs. There's a lot of news when it comes to terrorist threats. I mean, we've seen a series of different stories, including one just this Friday of an arrest of a man that was trying to enter the United States from Canada, who was inspired by ISIS and wanted to show his support of ISIS by planning a terrorist attack on October 7th to attack Jewish people in Brooklyn. So that's very close to home. We've saw a handful of U.S. soldiers recently injured in an operation in the Middle East to go after ISIS fighters. We've seen Central Command target some terrorists in Syria that are closely aligned with Al-Qaeda. There's a lot of activity that doesn't make the front page necessarily. And so I'm curious, how do they handle September 11th? And what if they don't handle it at all? Something I'm going to be very curious to think about. And also just how are they, what is the pacing? One of the things that we saw in the first debate was a lot of topics covered and it moved very quickly. On the one hand, that's great for the audience because we get a variety of different topics covered. On the other hand, it can feel rushed and you can feel like you don't really get enough information from either candidate. So these are things that behind closed doors, ABC is practicing. They're looking at all the camera angles. They're going over all the questions. They have a team of people that are looking at this. It's not just down to these two journalists, although they definitely have very likely an editorial role in what they decide to do and how they decide to divide this up. So I'll be watching and I'll be curious to see, you know, what transpires on Tuesday night and how that impacts the election. Let me show you this. A lot of time people think that the first presidential or televised presidential debate happened between John F. Kennedy Jr. and Nixon, and how, you know, John F. Kennedy Jr. looked young and thriving and Nixon didn't look that good. And that was part of the reason why John F. Kennedy Jr. won the presidential campaign. But the reality is the first presidential debate actually took place a few years before that. It just didn't take place with the candidates. This was a race between Dwight Eisenhower and Adlai Stevenson in 1956. And what they did, instead of having the candidates appear on television, they had surrogates. And the surrogates were women. One of them was Eleanor Roosevelt, yes, the former First Lady. And the other one was Senator Margaret Chase Smith. And she was representing the Republican side. Both of them were very well known. And so they had a debate on the issues representing the different political parties and the candidates. So they acted on behalf of the candidates. And apparently it was a very lively, very interesting debate that took place on CBS's Face the Nation, which was at the very first few years of that broadcast. But what an interesting way to approach a presidential debate. And I wonder, could we do some more events like that, even if the candidates aren't participating, actually use surrogates? This could be difficult, though, for the Republican Party, because right now the Republican Party has some more vocal splits as far as who's supporting former President Trump. And there was some news this weekend about an endorsement that Vice President Harris received from a well-known Republican, former Congresswoman Liz Cheney. And I want you to hear what Congresswoman Cheney had to say about her endorsement.
I've been voting for 40 years. My first vote I ever cast was for Ronald Reagan in 1984. I've never voted for a Democrat.
Wow.
It tells you, I think, the stakes in this election. You know, Donald Trump presents a challenge and a threat fundamentally to the Republic. We see it on a daily basis. Somebody who was willing to use violence in order to attempt to seize power, to stay in power. Someone who represents unrecoverable catastrophe, frankly, in my view. And we have to do everything possible to ensure that he doesn't, that he's not reelected. Given how close this race is, in my view, again, it's not enough. You have many Republicans out there who are saying, well, you know, we're not going to vote for him, but we will write someone else in.
Right.
And I think that this time around, that's not enough.
Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who's currently the governor of Arkansas, responded. And I want you to have at least a balance of what Liz Cheney said, who was critical of former President Trump. And here is Sarah Huckabee Sanders, who's trying to defend the candidate that she supports.
I think she actually is significantly
in the minority here. You look across the board, prominent Republicans are supporting President Trump. But ultimately, I think she's a non-factor. I'm not trying to be rude, but you don't get to call yourself a conservative or a Republican when you support the most radical nominee that the Democrats have ever put up. That doesn't make you a conservative. It certainly doesn't make you a Republican. I think it makes you somebody who wants to protect the establishment.
So I was curious about how much these endorsements actually do matter. I mean, Sarah Huckabee Sanders there clearly doesn't think that Liz Cheney's voice on this matter matters, but Liz Cheney disagrees because she's coming out and saying that not only is she against former President Trump, but she's going to actually vote for a Democrat for the first time. So you have two starkly different pictures of the Republican Party or conservative movement at this time. And I wanted to play this for you, not necessarily just down to this question about whether endorsement matters, but because this is something we're not necessarily seeing in the Democratic Party right now. We're not necessarily seeing this sort of battle. You're not seeing it in the same way. And although every political party has moments of a crisis of identity, you know, what do we stand for this election? What are we going to put up as part of our platform? This is a uniquely Republican moment here where you see two prominent women at odds really talking about the candidate at the top of the Republican ticket. Liz Cheney did have something to say a little bit later on in this interview. I want to play this for you because I think this might be an area to focus on during the debate. Let's take a listen.
It's not personal from my perspective, with one exception, and that is that I'm a mother. I'm the mother of five kids. And it is personal to me that my children grow up in a country where they know they can depend on the peaceful transfer of power, that they grow up in a country where their elected officials put fidelity to the Constitution first. That's how it's personal to me. It's personal to me when I listen to, fellow Republicans in the past say things to me like, well, it's fine, there are guardrails, you know, he can't do that much damage. It's just simply not true.
What I'm focusing on there is her reflection as a mother. We know statistics show that there are more women voters than men and that women vote at higher rates than men. So when people say women actually can decide an election, there's a reason for it. There's some data to support that. And I wonder if that's what's to watch for in the debate is a question of not only just substance, but also tone. How are both candidates going to really respond to this question about the future of America, keeping Americans safe, and also being figures that mothers across the country can look at their children and say, that's the president of the United States. And when it comes down to voting, we can get really complicated with the policy conversations, and rightfully so. Some of these issues are very complicated, but it tends to be more simple for voters where statistically, and even anecdotally, when we talk to political analysts and those that watch elections one after the other, despite all the complicated, unique things that we may be dealing with at this particular time, it comes down to really basic questions that we've talked about before. Am I safe? Is there a good future? How's the economy? It's not necessarily these layered, complicated decision. It's more of an instinctual one. Is that going to be the president that I want to represent America on the world stage? And I'm curious about how the behavior during this debate on both sides, the attitude, the tone, plays to that question, which is something that's harder to quantify because it's really personal how we're watching it. So I'll be curious to see that. By the way, I did look into whether or not political endorsements change voters. And political endorsements and celebrity endorsements, at least from the research, are sort of viewed the same way. It's very difficult to quantify whether or not they have any sort of impact at all. In fact, in one article I read, there was one person that stood out as potentially, according to some research that was done at several universities, impacted one election. And that was the election of Barack Obama. And it was Oprah's endorsement. Because up until that time, Oprah was known to be very apolitical and registered as an independent. But she came out in support of President Obama. And researchers say her move contributed 1 million votes in his direction. How did they get that? I'm not sure. But one of the kind of the headlines from this article was the more apolitical people appear, the greater impact they can have on voters. So it's not, you know, the people that are righteously Republican or righteously Democrat that have some sort of status don't necessarily have the same impact to bring voters with them. But someone that is extremely independent or not political at all has a much bigger capacity. And so even the celebrities, there's this question, you know, will Taylor Swift endorse anyone? You know, will so-and-so endorse anyone? And it turns out that in one particular survey, the actress Zendaya was the one that people were thinking, well, that could affect how I vote depending on what she says, but she hasn't endorsed anyone. So we're still attracted to the people that are apolitical to have an idea of maybe consideration about how we should vote rather than the people that are leaning one way or the next. I thought that was an interesting sort of takeaway. There are going to be two issues that are also right in front of us during the debate that came up just recently in the news. And one was about jobs and one is about school safety and guns. I want to just tackle both of those topics briefly. I'm going to start first with jobs because we got a jobs report out on Friday. Sometimes the news happens on Friday. It's easy to go by it. And the bottom line was it was fewer jobs were created than expected, but not terrible. Economists didn't freak out over this report. And basically what they were saying is, and we look at the economist's reaction to this, is that, you know, there was jobs created. It wasn't gangbusters. And that's actually what we want because the Federal Reserve has been trying to slow the economy down, slow the job market down even a little bit so that we can bring inflation down. So this is another sign that the economy has been slowed. We're seeing the inflation rate come down. That's, by the way, the rate coming down and you seeing a difference in prices is totally a different thing. The rate can come down, but, you know, prices can still maintain being high. And that's one of the reasons why when people talk about the rates versus actually what you're seeing at the grocery store, there can be a little bit of a disparity there. But what was interesting in this report is if you look back on the revision, so every time we get a monthly jobs report, we get a new unemployment rate and we get the certain amount of jobs created last month. So this was for September, looking at August. But we also get revisions because the data is fresh and then the economists that are part of the U.S. government go back and they look through it and they say, okay, well, wait a minute, this is miscounted and this is going in, and they're surveying people. This is how they're getting this number. They're using a few different ways to get to this number. If you look back on June and July, the revisions were pretty significant and they were downward. So the reported number of jobs created in the first headline, which gets the most attention, were actually way higher than the actual numbers of jobs that they think was created. So in July, for example, 114,000 jobs were announced, and they think maybe 89,000 jobs were created. If you look at the yearly results, we just got this back just recently. If we're looking at April of last year to March of this year, you can add up all the revisions and see, well, how does that compare to the, you know, actual number of jobs created versus the reported? And the statistics show, the data showed that we had 800,000 fewer jobs than were initially reported. This is typical. Revisions are very, very typical in the data. So it's not that this is a scandal. These are revisions that are taking place. You hope that the revisions are small because then you trust the data more to be accurate. But this also will be, we have to watch jobs and how they're going to be talked about in the debate and really the way the two parties are talking about this moving forward. Because something happened with jobs that is similar to what happened with immigration and the border. And that is our comparative data over the last year, in a few years, includes the pandemic. So the pandemic was a time when, for example, we lost all these jobs, and that was under former President Trump. But it was a unique time where there's a question about whether or not policy impacted that. Some people will say, yes, policy did. Some people will say, well, it was a one in 100-year event, and there was this huge drop of jobs. And so it's difficult to compare and contrast because we're not comparing ourselves to another pandemic time. The same is true of the border. President Trump will talk about how the border was so much more secure under his time in office, but we shut down the border completely, allowing nobody in during the pandemic. So it's not really a fair comparison because we didn't do the same thing over the last several years. Was it available to the Biden administration? Perhaps arguably, but it's really only used in a time of emergency. So these are where the data gets a little funky. And the bottom line for any of this, I just want you to walk away knowing that the revisions have been lower when it comes to the job market. The data is a little bit funky. You could just say, you could quote me on that. The data is a little bit funky when people are trying to use it to their benefit. It really comes to a question about how people feel about the economy. And what's been notable over the last year or so is that Americans are feeling more negative about the economy than the data would suggest. And some have been a little puzzled by this, but this is a great example. If the headline is showing a much better job market than actuality, Americans are living in the reality, not in the data. And so this is where we're seeing a little bit of a disparity here. And it's harder to solve how someone feels than actually solve the numbers. So just keep that in mind, because this is going to be an important part of the debate, not only for tomorrow, I would imagine, but as you're hearing from both sides getting closer to Election Day. Final thing I want to talk to you a little bit about, we got some questions on, is the Georgia school shooting that happened last week. And there's been a flurry of information that's come out over the last several days, and many of you have had questions about this as well. What we know now is there appears to have been a warning call from the mother of the school shooter calling the school because she received some sort of concerning text message from her son. And there were all sorts of things that could have added to the confusion at the moment, because her son had a very similar name with another boy that was actually in the same class. They were looking for this student. It seems to have been, in the moment, a lot of concern leading right up into the event, which is raising questions about how this could have been prevented, especially because we now know the FBI was called about a young man who is making threats against the school, this school shooter. And they were alerted. They referred it to local authorities. Local authorities questioned the boy and his father. They didn't have any grounds to do anything further than do that, but it was enough that they were aware of this family. We also know that family and social services in the area were alerted because of the dynamics in this household. So a lot of people knew about this school shooter before he actually perpetrated these crimes. We know he is charged with murder, and his father is also facing some very, very serious charges. Barbara, you had a good question about this that I want to share with everybody.
This is Barbara from North Carolina. I am curious about the precedent being set of charging the parents of a school shooter with practically the same charges that the shooter him or herself has. And I guess what I mean by that is I can see a need for a charge of improper storage of a firearm or negligence of some sort. I can see that, but I'm curious about the hardcore charging that is going on. Is there precedence for that in other situations? I understand a message is trying to be sent, but I'm just kind of curious about how that all plays out.
It's a great question, Barbara. Thank you for that, because this is notable. It is something new. It's not the first time that we've seen it, though, and I want to talk to you a little bit about the other time that we have seen this. It actually took place with two parents back in 2021, and I should preface, the event took place in 2021. It was a shooting that happened at Oxford High School in Michigan, and there was a 15-year-old that opened fire at the school, killed four students, injured seven other people. He had a handgun, and he was charged with these crimes. His parents, James and Jennifer Crumbly, and I'm reading here from a few different things, were also charged. And the reason for this is that school officials at the time had actually brought the parents into the school to say, hey, we're concerned about some of these drawings that he's doing in class, and we're feeling very worried about it. We'd actually like you to take your kid home from school. And the parents decided not to take their kid home from school. And that was the same day that this crime happened. So the shooter pleaded guilty to 24 felonies. That included murder and terrorism. And then his parents also faced several criminal charges. And this actually, this kind of case is jogging your memory, this part of the court case just came to fruition this year. So they were found guilty of four counts of involuntary manslaughter. They had separate trials. They've each been sentenced to 10 to 15 years. So part of the reason why these parents were charged wasn't just the dynamic of parenting, but because they actually gave the gun to their child. Obviously not to do a crime, but this was something true that we saw in the household of this school shooter as well in Georgia, that he had access to these weapons because of his father. Now, there's a question about whether or not we could see more laws that would require certain things about gun storage or, you know, any number of further restrictions. Those can be very difficult to pass. But the reason why this case was important is that it was the first time we saw a criminal charge of, or prosecution of the parents. And so what you're seeing now in a separate state is another criminal prosecution of a parent. So this is new, and it is something that prosecutors are finding, at least in this case out of Michigan, success in prosecuting a parent. The parent in this particular case in Georgia faces very serious charges. And so we'll see what sort of case is built against him. So this may be a way where you wonder if there's not a particular law that's passed in, you know, when we're looking at different laws related to guns, is this also a deterrent somehow for parents to know that if your child is guilty of a crime that involves a weapon that you bought that was in your household, you can also be criminally prosecuted. There's been cases that have been civilly prosecuted, but not this is a criminal charge. So this is new. And it's important to note that it's new. Mary also had a question as well. And I think she reflects a lot of the feeling that we were getting on Smarter News last week. So I'd like to play this in full for Mary.
Mary Remis here. I've been a follower from the beginning, and I always appreciate your calm, clear approach to the news. I'm calling from Georgia, where I live, and I'm just devastated that we've had yet another school shooting. As a gun owner, I understand the reluctance of people. I get it. I understand the reluctance to give up their firearms, especially because we just lack trust and confidence in our government, and that's sad. But also, I'm a parent and I'm a grandparent, and I can't bear the thought of another innocent child being killed at school. And I know the problem runs so much deeper than simply passing a law or banning guns, but it also feels like failing to take any action because it won't solve everything. It's just dangerously irresponsible. And I feel like it's keeping us stuck, that we're choosing to be here because we can't get past gridlock. The other thing that's frustrating is when I Googled to find out what exactly are the gun laws in Georgia, there's a lot of conflicting information out there. So I understand why the infighting is so strong. To be honest, I've lost faith in congressional leaders. So I've shifted my focus to my own state of Georgia. I wrote last week to my state representative asking for a dialogue or a task force or some kind of meaningful initiative that would bring citizens together to solve some of these problems. We are smart. We are problem solvers. I know we can come up with some answers that will at least move us forward and get us out of this stuckness that we seem to be in. I remember when my children were little and Columbine happened, and I just can't believe that here we are all these years later. And now I'm thinking about this for my grandchildren. It's nuts. So all that context brings me to my question for you. What can we as citizens do to affect real change in our communities? Running for office is one option, but my representative has been in office for 19 years and not likely to be defeated. He's not going anywhere. Is there a way for citizens to coalesce, to come up with solutions, and then take them to our representatives with a clear message saying, pass this? Let's try this. If it doesn't work, we'll try something else. Whatever problem it creates, we'll fix that problem. Because after all, they do work for us, right? That's it, Jenna. Thanks so much for your time and for always being the voice of reason. I so appreciate you.
Well, I appreciate you too, Mary. Thank you so much for that question and the way that you described it, because I think that'll resonate with so many to understand there's so many different dynamics to this story. And oftentimes the news will focus on just one, but it's not giving the whole conversation the time to breathe that we need. One of the things that Mary pointed out I think is important is that we do have different gun laws depending on what state you're in. And it can be difficult to kind of figure out, well, what are the differences? What's working? What's not? I was looking at a graphic last week that was talking about where some of the school shootings took place. But if you look closer to it, it was tough to know. You know, it was just another reminder about how the data can be used, where you could say, well, there's more school shootings in these particular states, but were there 10x school shootings? Or was there just one school shooting and the other state didn't have any? And that's where you're getting the data. School shooting data also is very difficult to compile depending on what group you're following. In some cases, any discharge of a gun on school grounds is called a school shooting. rather than actually a crime taking place. So, for example, if this is a wild example, but let's just take an example where a security guard accidentally shoots a gun that could, in some cases, be considered part of the data. Let's say in a more unfortunate example would be if someone commits suicide on school grounds. That would be counting as a school shooting. But if you and I were reading something about statistically about school shootings, that may not be a picture that we had. We may be thinking about a school shooting like the one we saw in Georgia. So I just am adding this because it's a reminder that that's part of the complexity of this conversation is that sometimes the data that we're using also is not all the same. We're in different states that have different state laws. We have different requirements for school security. The one thing I thought would be helpful to actually share with you is this, and this is an interview I did a few years ago, but I want to remind you of it because Mary was saying, you know, how do we come together? What do we do? So ALERT is the leading, it's a leading expert or groups when it comes to school security. And they, as you can see on the screen right now, hold conferences. You can request to come to a class. You can learn about their certification. You can have an idea of whether or not your school, for example, has this sort of training. These are the guys that are going to work with the FBI. They're the ones that are going to be working with local school security. And they're here, you're saying the mission is to provide the best research-based active shooter response training in the nation. And so one of the places that you can just start is looking here and understanding, hey, the place where my kids are going to school or the place that my grandkids are going to school, did they have ALERT training? Has the school looked into ALERT training? What is that? Can I request that for the school? So this is a good place just to go and kind of poke around and get some information about school security. I understand it's not as complicated or robust of a conversation as changing legislation. But if you're looking for actionable advice, I think this is actually a good place to start. And it's ALERT, ALERT.org. And so you can, there's a bunch of training here available on the website. There's research. They did a whole deep dive as well about the shooting that happened at Uvalde. So this is a good, because these are the leading experts, this is where I would go to just start educating yourself about what do we know about school shootings? What about the data? What sort of resources are available if we can make our schools safer? And that can be something that doesn't require lawmakers or politics. It may be that your school's looking for something like that and they don't really know about ALERT. So can we send some people to the ALERT training facility in Texas? Can ALERT come out and do some training for the district? And that's just something that we've stumbled upon in our reporting that I think would be helpful to you. So I'll make sure that that's available in the show notes as well. These are never easy stories to cover. And we would hope that we would never have to cover another one. They're frightening and they're difficult. And especially in this particular case, avoidable. That's where the facts of this show us. It wasn't that law enforcement wasn't aware of this individual or that the teachers weren't aware of this individual or the family wasn't aware of this individual or the family resources in the area wasn't aware of this individual. That's what makes a case like this particularly maddening, because there were multiple people that were aware. And it reminds me very much of the Parkland shooting that took place in Florida. I interviewed a father of one of the girls that was killed. Meadow was her name. And the father said to me, you know, obviously he lost his daughter. Nothing's worse than that. But to know that the school was aware that the student that ended up doing this crime was well known to everyone was a part that was very difficult to understand how it couldn't be stopped. So that also gives us perspective on some of the legislation or laws or restrictions also that law enforcement is perhaps working within to try to be by the book, also pursue leads, innocent until proven guilty. I mean, This was very curious to see what else we learn about this as the days go on, the specifics of how close law enforcement or family services was to this particular case. So just something to think about. Always remember what the father told me as well. He said, if there's one thing you can do with your children, he said, I wish I did more of, is that I would take them for walks. Because when kids are walking, they start talking to you. And he said, I think if I would have taken my daughter for a walk, I wonder if the name of this child would have come up as just somebody that she was concerned about. And I've thought about that a lot as my kids are getting older, you know, getting them out for walks so they just start talking and tell you the things that you're not going to see because you're not in school with them. So extremely tough and extremely sad story. And as we learn more about it, we'll, of course, share that with you. I'm curious about how these recent news items, whether it's about terrorism, whether it's about school shootings, whether it's about jobs, these very recent news items are going to be woven into the debate this week, or if not. And so this is one of the reasons why I wanted to make sure that we cover that for you. I'm going to leave us with something that's a little bit more uplifting. And we got some news this morning from the royal family. Typically, we don't cover a lot of royal family news. I know it's an area of interest, but typically it's not something that we necessarily cover in the same way that we cover other things. But this message was a good message in that it was from Princess Kate. And she was announcing the end of her cancer treatment. And she released a video that was talking about the road forward and also giving encouragement to those that are perhaps going through some difficult times. And there's a full video. It's about 3 minutes. I've cut it in half just to share it with you. But the message was one of positivity and optimism. And I feel like there can be a shortage of that sometimes with the news, and I don't want Smarter News to be part of that. So I'm going to leave you with this thought today. We'll be back with more coverage of the debate. So keep your questions coming. If you have a question, if you're watching the debate and there's something you want to talk about, you go ahead and you can email us hello@smarternews.com or scoop@smarternews.com. And we'll use your voice notes, which are always great, as you can see, to talk about what transpired on Tuesday. And I'm curious, we'll see how this could forever set or change the course of the election of 2024. So we'll be watching for that. So in the meantime, let me leave you with this, some beautiful, if you're watching, some beautiful imagery of the royal family and an uplifting message as well for Princess Kate. If you have more questions, go ahead and jump into the comments and I'll answer them. And of course, throughout the week, we'll be available as always on social media and online, smarternews.com. with quick, concise, nonpartisan information during this very busy time. Have a great week. I'll talk to you soon.
Doing what I can to stay cancer-free is now my focus. Although I have finished chemotherapy, my path to healing and full recovery is long, and I must continue to take each day as it comes. I am, however, looking forward to being back at work and undertaking a few more public engagements in the coming months when I can. Despite all that's gone before, I enter this new phase of recovery with a renewed sense of hope and appreciation of life. William and I are so grateful for the support we've received and have drawn great strength from all those who are helping us at this time. Everyone's kindness, empathy, and compassion has been truly humbling. To all those who are continuing their own cancer journey, I remain with you, side by side, hand in hand. Out of darkness can come light, so let that light shine bright.
Thank you for believing in quick, concise, nonpartisan, smarter news. Every time you join us or share or save our content, you help us build a solution in news, and we are so grateful. We have a few other ways you can support our mission, from joining our insider community Scoop to shopping our gear at our Smarter Shop to just telling a friend. The best way to do any of this is to visit smarternews.com or follow us at Smarter News on social media. Don't worry, we put all of this in the captions so it's easy for you. Plus, we added our email just in case you want to drop us a note. We always love hearing from you. Thank you for helping us deliver news smarter.